You are listening to On the Daily, the RotoViz Daily Fantasy Sports Podcast, powered by RotoViz Radio.
Hey everyone, I'm Matt Friedman, Matt at the Oracle of the Action Network and RotoViz. Welcome to the March 23rd, 2018 NASCAR edition of On the Daily. I'm joined by Dr. Nick Giffen, an owner of RotoViz, a PhD in mathematics, a three-time qualifier for the DraftKings NASCAR main event, one of the best NASCAR DFS players in the world. You can follow him on Twitter at RotoDoc. Nick, how's it going?
Hey, Matt, I'm doing well. Yeah, we had obviously a little bit of scheduling issues, so we didn't have the midweek show, but we're going to obviously try to combine some of the midweek and the weekend show to get you guys ready for Martinsville this week, and I'm excited. Martinsville's a super fun race.
Yes, we are powering through. I can't even describe to you, although I'm going to try to describe to you the situation right now. So I am at my in-laws with my wife, and right now I am recording. I'm sitting at like a little kid's desk, you know, like for grandchildren, and my legs barely fit underneath the table. And I'm like off in some little porch somewhere because people are going to sleep. So I'm trying to get like in the room, like in the most remote location of the house so that I don't wake anyone up. So it's, yeah, it's a situation we got going on here. So yeah,
I've done that before. I had we had a podcast and I think I was in like the mountains of Asheville just trying to
get right.
any little bit of internet I could. And I was holed up in like our little cabin room there and made a makeshift like dresser into a desk or whatever. But yeah, I know the feeling, but we power on. That's what we do
here. We power on because those 30% discounts aren't going to plug themselves. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. That's right.
All right. Martinsville. The sixth race of the season, really interesting in that all the practice sessions take place before qualifying, and there's also the possibility of weather, which could impact the proceedings on Saturday and Sunday. But before we talk about Martinsville, let's look back at Auto Club Speedway. Martin Truex Jr. dominated. He ultimately picked up his first win of the year over Kyle Larson, who finished in second. Nick, talk about the winning DFS lineup and any lessons we can take away from Auto Club.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty, I guess you could say, routine race. There wasn't a whole lot of challenges for the lead. You know, Martin Truex Jr. definitely dominated a lot of it, but Kyle Busch did get out front for a good portion of the time. And so, you know, those two were the two dominators we had in our 200-lap race. We talked about the fact that, you know, do you want to go one dominator or two dominators, which seemed most likely because we only had 200 laps instead of 325 or 312 or whatever. And we had all of those drivers coming from the back. We had, remember, 13 drivers that failed inspection last week. And, of course, after you and I recorded the podcast last week, several hours later, or I think it was the next morning maybe, NASCAR decided that they'd give all those teams that did qualify fresh tires for the start of the race. So that kind of changed the analysis a little bit, made Harvick more of a viable play. I thought Harvick was going to be one of the best fades ever. And then they gave Harvick fresh tires. So, you know, he charged his way up to the third or fourth place, but then he made a bad move and wrecked. He tried to pass Kyle Larson and got too aggressive and got loose and spun out and hit the wall. And Kevin Harvick was the first driver out of the race. So, certainly was an interesting race. That made it a three-horse race between Kyle Busch, Martin Truex Jr., and Kyle Larson. But Larson did have to come from the back a couple times to repair minor damage from the Harvick incident. But he came forward and ultimately finished second. So it was really Truex and Kyle Busch dominating the proceedings, and they ended up in the winning lineup. Another driver that ended up in the winning lineup was Clint Bowyer. He started 19th, and he was a driver I highlighted on RotoViz Live as my air quote Paul Menard pick of the week. One of those drivers there who, you know, probably would be under-owned and seemed to have a good situation. He had a good track history, good track type history, started 19th, practiced 14th in the single lap and 10 lap average. And you figure if a couple people have some problems, he can finish inside the top 10 there. He did pull off a top 10 finish. So he was also in the winning lineup. Cole Witt was also in the winning lineup. He started dead last among all of those drivers, but you knew he was faster than Greg Golding, Jeffrey Earnhardt, Timmy Hill. So you knew he was going to pass a few of those drivers, add in some wrecks and some other drivers falling out for different reasons. He ended up in the winning lineup as a Joe Dirt Cheap driver. The other two drivers I thought were interesting were Jimmy Johnson, who I highlighted in my article as a cash game play, and also meant he's fine in GPPs. If you like in NASCAR, if you like somebody in cash, you like them in GPPs. Jimmy Johnson started way back there in the back in 33rd as one of the casualties to the inspection issue, as well as already having had several bad races earlier this year. It put him even further back because of those 13 drivers that missed the inspection process. Jimmy Johnson was one of the lowest in points, so he was a very obvious play. And then the other one that I think is super interesting and was another one of the sneaky plays was William Byron. And I talked about on Road of His Live how William Byron, I think, will be the lowest owned of all of those good drivers starting from 25th to 33rd or 34th, where Johnson and Allmendinger were starting. I thought Byron would be the lowest owned. He was, but he is in the Hendrick Motorsports car. Sure, they've underperformed this year, but it's hard to count on such a talented rookie who's performed or who's in a car that has in the past performed very well and is low owned. So I told everybody to get overweight on William Byron. Thought he'd be around 20-something percent owned, and he was. So William Byron ended up in the winning lineup. So again, Kyle Busch and Truex as the dominators. Clint Bowyer finished in the top 10. Jimmy Johnson all the way from the back. Cole Whitt is your Joe Dirt cheap driver, and William Byron from the back toward the front as well, kind of like Jimmy Johnson, but at a much lower price. And I was overweight on all six drivers, so certainly we gave out, I think, some good advice. Unfortunately, I didn't have all six in the same lineup in the Beast there, but I know several Road of His readers did very well.
All right, so you also had a betting article that was on the Action Network. How did your picks do?
Yeah, I guess, they did about as well as you can for not winning. But I didn't pick Kevin Harvick, and he did end up wrecking out. He came from 10th forward and had that wreck with Larson, as I talked about. But Truex won the race, and I didn't pick him. I picked Kyle Larson, Kyle Busch, and Brad Keselowski, who finished fourth and was 22.5-1, finished fourth. So this is like the third week out of four that my picks there have finished inside the top five without a win. And then the other week, of course, I picked a winner there with your prop bets that swept the board. So doing pretty well on those bets. We'd just like to hit more winners, but I'm okay with every single driver finishing in the top five multiple weeks now.
It's too bad it's not a little more like horse racing where, you can bet on them to place, to show, like if we were doing it like that, your picks would be killing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I mean, there are occasionally on some sites, Five Dimes offers a top three. So maybe I'll do some of those for the Action Network going forward. We'll see. But right now doing picks to win, and it's tough to win. I mean, you can't win every week, but I've won one out of the – I didn't do it for Daytona, but we've had four races since, and I've won one out of the four. Parlayed with your prop bets as suggested, we're still breaking almost essentially even, and then all of my other picks have basically finished inside the top five except my one long shot, which was Alex Bowman at Phoenix. He had a bit of a struggle there that race, but every single other pick has finished inside the top five.
All right, let's talk about Martinsville. It is a 0.526 mile flat track. It often produces a lot of contact between cars. Talk about the racing that we should expect to see this weekend.
Yeah, I love racing at Martinsville. It's just so cool because there's really only one way around, and that's on the bottom line there. It's really tough to make passes on the outside. It's not impossible, but it's extremely, extremely tough to make passes on the outside at Martinsville. So usually the way to do it is to get a good run off the corner and get underneath the car in front of you coming off the corner. That way they can't come down to the bottom line going into the next set of corners, so you're already underneath them and they have to give the position up. Sometimes the way to get around them is to just be aggressive and hit their rear bumper and kind of loosen them up and get them out of the way, shove them out of the way, but occasionally that can lead to issues like putting a driver into the wall or spinning them out. And then they retaliate, and it gets kind of ugly at Martinsville. But because it is such a flat track, a small track, there is only one lane. Track position is absolutely premium at Martinsville. You want to start up front. It's only a little over a half mile, so it's very easy to go a lap down early and quickly. And once you get multiple laps down, then it's hard to make up a lot of track position, so you really don't want to go multiple laps down. If you go one lap down, you can usually get a wave around and or the lucky dog and get back on the lead lap. And, of course, at the end of the race, if we see lots of cautions, That could help if you're one or two laps down, you'd be okay. But certainly if you're more than two laps down, it's a really long day. You really don't want to go two laps down anyway, because it's already going to be a long day at that point. But with the stages, it does make it a little bit easier to you know, maybe do some strategy or different things to kind of stay on the lead lap or get back on the lead lap, or at least not go two laps down. Yeah, track position is absolutely premium at Martinsville because it's a flat track and braking is so important. You want to get on the brake, off the brake, on the throttle, very technique oriented. And sometimes you see a lot of drivers who do well at road course races do well at Martinsville. Yeah, it's definitely a technical track, and one where track position is ultimately the most important thing.
Okay, much more to talk about with Martinsville. Before that, I want to remind everyone that you can get a 30% discount to a special NASCAR pass through our NASCAR podcast homepage, rotoviz.com/NASCAR podcast. With that pass, you get unlimited access to all of Nick's premium NASCAR content, and your subscription supports the pod. Okay, Nick, you mentioned that track position is incredibly important at Martinsville. What are the other stats that are important for the model this weekend?
Yeah, so there's really three main things in the model that are important for Martinsville. There's a couple kind of like really secondary things, but there's three big ones that stand out. The first one is the 10-lap average in final practice. That shows up in all of the top 30 models is the 10-lap average. And you're going to get 10-lap averages for most cars here because it's a half-mile track. We got a lot of 10, 15, sometimes even 20-lap averages last weekend at Auto Club, and that's a two-mile track. So we'll see here some 20, 30, maybe even longer runs at Martinsville this weekend in practice, if we get practice in, as we'll talk about. But we'll see some long runs at Martinsville, and that is the number one thing that shows up in the model. The other two factors that show up in the model, of course, our recent performance. How have you done this year? Maybe dipping a little bit back in the last year. So we've had four non-restrictor plate races so far this year. Take those four races and then the four final races from last year and balance them about 50-50. That is a factor in the model. It's not as important as practice, but it's certainly a factor in the model. It's not quite as important as the next factor I'll talk about, which is track history. So the track driver rating actually shows up in all three of the top three models in terms of future making predictions on unseen data. And so that's track driver rating, whereas last eight non-restrictor plate driver rating shows up in only two of the top three models. So I think track history is a little bit more important than recent history for all the drivers. So coin flip, give weight, you know, between recent history and track history, give weight to track history at Martinsville. It's such a unique track, such a technical track, that it definitely, is the thing we want to pay attention to. Some other things, Martinsville does have a little bit of an interesting, I guess, condition to it, in that some drivers learn how to drive Martinsville over the years. So longer term track history and shorter term track history both come into play, using the last four Martinsville races versus the last eight Martinsville races. Both show up in the model, weighted much more heavily to the last eight races, but there is some little bit of weight you can give to the last four Martinsville races, so that if a driver has done better over the past two or so years at Martinsville, that's a lot more important than their longer term history of eight races at Martinsville. Not more important, I should say, but could affect, could make an adjustment to their longer term history models. So if they struggled, you know, 3-4 years ago, but then they've learned to make adjustments, that does show up. And one driver who was famous for that, which doesn't show now, but I'm talking back in the day, was Kyle Busch. He did struggle at this track many years ago, but over the last 4, 5, 6 years, he's been much better here. But previously, had this discussion 3 years ago, 2 years ago, we would have said Kyle Busch is one of those drivers who had maybe poor long-form Martinsville history, but very good short-form Martinsville history. So there's a couple of drivers like that, but the short-form Martinsville history, the last 2 years or so, is the lowest factor of the four that I just mentioned there in the model.
How predictive is the model for Martinsville?
Yeah, it's not too predictive, let's just say that. And there's many reasons for that. Obviously, it's a unique track, so it requires a unique set of skills, and you get some – it's hard to say, like, okay, well, you know, A.J. Allmendinger has been terrible this year, but he has a great Martinsville history. How do you balance those? So that's one part where the model just – it tries to balance it, and it does as well as it can. And that's why you have these machine learning models to do this. But even then, it's hard for a machine to figure that out. So that's one reason. But the second reason, and the most important reason, is just the fact that we get so many cautions here. And all of these cautions can keep a lot of cars, shuffled, and some get sent to the back because they get spun out. Others, do strategy and get track position because of all the different cautions. When there's a lot of cautions, you can do a lot of different things with strategy. So you get a lot of strategy. Restarts bunch everybody up, so there's a lot of shuffling on restarts. And because we get a lot of late race cautions, that means a lot of things can happen late in the race that essentially render a lot of the beginning part of the race useless. So I did say it's tough when you get a lap down or two laps down, or especially three laps down, but it's not unrecoverable. You just don't want to, but certainly when you get about three laps down, it's usually pretty unrecoverable. But one or two laps down, you can get back on the lead lap there late in the race, and all of a sudden things can get shuffled up with a couple late race cautions there. So the main reason is because of all the cautions that we see at Martinsville. Tracks like Martinsville and Bristol are even less predictive than tracks like Auto Club or Atlanta that have the high tire wear, where we talk about a lot of strategy comes into play, or teams or drivers can blow their tires. Another factor at Martinsville is brake. The drivers can wear out their brakes or melt their beads. We saw, at Phoenix that happened to Paul Menard, and Martinsville is another short flat track where that can happen. So not only crashes, but things like brake failures can also come into play in such a long, long race. It's 500 laps, so it's a half, just over a half mile track, which means only just barely over 250 miles, but it's 500 laps, and the laps aren't turned at the fastest pace. The average lap is around 90 something miles an hour, so compare that to an average lap of 180 miles an hour, you're going to half the speed. So it essentially feels like a 500 mile race, even though it's just barely over 250 miles. So it's a long race, and many things can happen at Martinsville. That's what makes it much more, much less predictable, I should say, than a lot of the cookie cutter mile and a half that we go to in NASCAR.
Okay, so practice is important, just for any of the models. That holds true for Martinsville, but both of the practice sessions are taking place before qualifying. So how does that impact the model, and how does that impact the way that DFS players should look at practice?
Yeah, I don't think it really impacts the model too much, because the model isn't taking into consideration short run speed. And that's where we're worried about, are they in qualifying setup? Is the single lap average misrepresentative of how they'll actually perform in the race? But the single lap speed doesn't show up in the model at all. If I look at the top several models where I could build this model off of, single lap speed doesn't show up in any of the top 30 models. So ignore single lap speed at Martinsville. And that's okay, because even though the practice sessions are before qualifying, no driver is going to make a 10 lap run in qualifying trim. So we can continue to use practice as normal. Just make sure you're ignoring single lap speed this weekend, essentially. How does that affect DFS? Well, if anybody does use single lap speed, that's a total exploitation right there. You should absolutely be looking at 10 lap average. And especially for DFS players, you should be watching practice, picking up wherever they happen to show 15, 20, 25, 30 lap averages at Martinsville. That's going to be very important as well. Obviously there's diminishing returns as more laps are turned. There's fewer cars that complete that number of laps. So, if everybody does a 10 lap average, maybe only 30 cars will do a 20 lap average, and maybe only 10 cars will do a 30 lap average. So there's diminishing returns, and there's diminishing returns because as you go longer and longer and longer into the run, more and more likely we are to hit a caution. So it renders extremely long run performance useless anyway. So I like looking at that 20 lap average. Really is kind of like the 20 to 25, 30 lap average for me is really the sweet spot at Martinsville. So if TV happens to show that in any of the two practice sessions, make sure you jump on that as a key data point, because the model only takes into account 10 lap average, because that's all the publicly released data that we have since 2005 per NASCAR. But TV does have access to longer run speeds there. So that's kind of a data point you can add in yourself that isn't going to exist in the model.
All right. Well, one thing that complicates the practice situation is that on Saturday, there's a strong chance of rain and maybe even snow. What happens if weather impacts the practice sessions and qualifying. What does that mean for DFS?
Yeah, it's an interesting weekend because this is one of NASCAR's compressed weekends. So instead of the Friday, Saturday, Sunday schedule, it's just a Saturday, Sunday schedule that they're kind of, I wouldn't say experimenting with. They implemented it a couple times last year, but they're definitely trying to see if this is something that makes sense going forward. And I do think it makes sense. So I'm going to go off a little tangent here before I answer your question. I do think it makes sense for the fans to just have to come Friday and Saturday, just Saturday and Sunday. I think it makes sense for the teams. They spend a lot less money if they just have to make it a 2-day weekend and a multiple day weekend. I know the media loves it. They don't have to go out another day earlier and stay an extra day. And so I know the media always pushes these shortened schedules. But when something like a weather event happens, it really complicates things because what if all of Saturday gets wiped out by rain and or snow? Then what? What happens then? Do you have just no practice for the race on Sunday? I guess so. I mean, that's probably what's going to happen if weather does impact all of Saturday. Now, I think we probably will have some periods. There is 100% chance, essentially, for weather to happen. It's just a question of when will it happen. If it happens late enough in the day, they could get the first practice session in. Or maybe there's a period where there's no precipitation and they can dry the track or melt the snow and then dry the track. Who the hell knows? But I think this compressed schedule allows for some issues like this where teams might be racing with absolutely no practice. So certainly there's that consideration as maybe a negative to all of the positives about having a shortened race weekend. But as far as the practice sessions, if there's no practice, we don't have a lot to go by. I mean, we 10 lap average shows up in all the top models. And if we don't get a 10 lap average, what do? Well, you look at how they've done this year and how they performed at Martinsville. That's really the only pieces of data that make sense. You'd give more weight to, as I mentioned, to Martinsville history just because, recent history is just, I should say last, this year history plus some of last year is less important. But that's really all we have to go by. So there's nothing else we can take out of this. So it comes down to evaluation like that. But then everybody does that same evaluation. If they're all thinking the same thing, and with Martinsville being very unpredictable, I do think it becomes a good weekend to kind of – and we'll talk about this later in the show, but I think it becomes a good weekend to maybe exploit ownership percentages and things like that.
Okay, so near certainty for rain and snow tomorrow, tomorrow being Saturday. So if that happens, it looks like NASCAR would throw a competition caution early in Sunday's race to allow teams to check their tire wear. How does that impact DFS strategy, if at all, and specifically in regard to the cars that might dominate and then also the cars that would maybe go down a lap early?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. And then also, obviously, qualifying can be affected. So we might start the field by owner points because Saturday evening is when most of the stuff's forecast, and qualifying is Saturday afternoon, evening, Eastern time. So we might not have qualifying, and in that case, Martin Truex Jr. would be on the pole based off of owner points. But so owner points could certainly come into play here. The competition caution could certainly come into play here. You'd expect with Martin Truex Jr. on the pole, he'd probably get the early jump on things. Although at Phoenix, he was on the pole and he got passed by Kyle Larson there. So you don't know. But as far as the competition caution, maybe they throw it at lap 40 or 50. I'd expect it would be a little later in terms of number of laps than it would be at another track where it's maybe 25, 30, 35 lap is where the competition caution comes, just because Martinsville is such a short track. So that obviously means they're pitting earlier than they need to. They can do over 100 lap run on fuel. They can do the same amount on tires. Tire wear isn't super huge at Martinsville. It does help, obviously, having fresh tires, but it's not massively important there. So you could see teams that maybe want to, or maybe go down a lap early, or maybe are close to going down a lap early, stay out and just get back on the lead lap there. And then they know a stage ending caution will come in another 100 or so laps and end the stage there. So I think it helps some of these back marker. I wouldn't say back marker, not like the worst of the worst, like your Timmy Hills or anything like that. But some of these guys like your Ty Dillons or maybe your Bubba Wallace's, that kind of range, maybe helped by this early competition caution where maybe they go a lap down they can get back on the lead lap, or maybe they're right on the tail end of going a lap down and they get saved by that competition caution. So it does help them, all of these drivers, early on in the proceedings. That said, it's Martinsville. There's going to be other cautions. So I think what happens early in the race isn't going to be super important for some of these back markers, but it does help just a little bit to have an extra guaranteed caution. As far as the dominators, I do think that is maybe a negative for somebody like a Martin Truex Jr., especially with what we've seen this year in the pit stops, which are a little more variable in terms of their time. You know, many, many years now, they've been optimized under six crew members over the wall. And, you know, we're seeing pit stop times come down from many years ago to, 14 seconds all the way down to 11 and a half, 11, pushing the 11 second range, and very little variance from, pit stops between 11 and 12 and a half seconds or something like that. Well, now with one less crew member, the new choreography team still learning this, we're seeing pit stops anywhere from 13 and a half to 16 seconds. And it's been more variable among these teams and their consistency. So I do think it makes it harder for a single driver to dominate. And any extra caution makes it a little bit harder for a single driver to dominate. I think that's why we've seen some races this year with, outside of the Kevin Harvick extreme dominance, where you've had multiple dominators. Like we had at Phoenix last week at Auto Club Speedway. We theoretically could have had multiple dominators if Harvick and Larson didn't have their problems. So, I definitely think it makes Truex a little bit less of a super likely dominator. Obviously, starting on the pole, there's an advantage to that with the pit stall you get if he does start on the pole. But it also does disadvantage him just a little bit more in that it's more likely somebody else hops to the point there after that competition caution.
Okay, so as far as the race on Sunday, there's no precipitation in the forecast, but the high is expected to be in the low 40s. So it's pretty cold. We don't normally see a temperature that cold for racing conditions. How does that impact the race?
Yeah, I mean, that's super cold for Martinsville and just for NASCAR racing in general. They build the schedule around making sure weather is not as much of an issue as possible. That's why they go to Michigan in June and July, or they go to some of these tracks up in the north in June or July, because it's better than going to those tracks in the north in like September or October. So vice versa, they go to a lot of the southern tracks like in February and March because they're warmer and those climates are just warmer, and so that's why they do them early and late in the season. That's why you'll see Daytona, well, not Daytona, but like Phoenix will be very early in the season and very late in the season. Texas, very early in the season, very late in the season. Things like that. But as far as Martinsville goes, we normally don't see temperatures in the low 40s. We don't see it really anywhere in NASCAR. But with Martinsville specifically, one area that will impact the racing is the brake temperatures. There's a lot of braking at Martinsville, lots and lots and lots of braking. And you can still build heat in the brakes at Martinsville in 40-degree weather. It's just going to make it a lot harder for it to really melt and cause some kind of tire failure in 40-degree weather versus 85-degree weather or 90-degree weather, or the sun's beating down on an 85-degree day and track temperatures are 115 degrees, something like that. That is a massive difference. So I think we'll see very few brake issues from overheating, it'll make that part of the attrition equation a little bit less. As far as the racing itself, teams do get more grip under colder conditions, so it could make passing on the outside that much harder as well, just because there's so much less opportunity for cars to slide on the inside lane, that I think the outside lane, passing the inside lane is more of a likelihood at 80 or 90 degree temperatures than it is at 40 degree temperatures. So I think track position is going to be very, 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 very important this weekend at Martinsville.
Okay, with all the uncertainty around practice and the weather that might render key pieces of data unavailable, what does that mean for GPPs and how DFS players should approach them?
Yeah, well, obviously, if we don't have 10-lap average at all, and it is in all of my top 30 most predictive models, that is like the key piece of data that we don't have. The other two main pieces of data are what have you done at Martinsville and what have you done lately just overall. And then there's some short-term Martinsville history that comes into play, and then really, really, really tiny pieces of data that is like, what have you done just this year, not going back in the last year, those four races as well. But that's all the data that goes into my model this weekend, my most predictive model this weekend. And I always use the one that's the most predictive. So essentially the biggest piece of data is missing. However, we know that races are more unpredictable than ownership percentage. We've shown it time and again. My models generally outside of, you know, Martinsville, Bristol, and the road courses and the restrictor plate races, you take those six tracks out of the equation. The other 18 or so tracks on NASCAR schedule all range between 0.5 and 0.65 R squared for the most part, give or take a little bit, but much more predictive than those other six tracks. But the bulk of them is between 0.5 and 0.65. Ownership percentage projections generally are between 0.7 and 0.9. So we are much more confident in predicting ownership than we are in predicting the outcome of the race. And I still expect that to continue. And where I think it is important is I think the gap increases between ownership percentage confidence or prediction and race prediction, because we're missing a huge key, the most important piece of data. All of a sudden the model goes from 0.4 to 0.35 or 0.2 or 0.25, somewhere in that range. I don't know what it is without I should actually probably look it up what it is without 10 lap average for Martinsville, but you lose all that, but you still mostly gain all of that ownership percentage confidence. So you know in general where people will be going with drivers, not perfectly, obviously. You do lose a key piece of data as well, an ownership percentage in terms of 10 lap average being important. But all the other factors that come into play, people think they matter more than they do. And ownership percentages will definitely be something to exploit this weekend should we have no practice sessions at all.
Okay, so practice data normally goes into your ownership projection model. So if practice data is missing, how does that impact the ownership projections you have?
It'll definitely impact it, and that's why I said ownership projections will be certainly impacted, but I think race projections will be impacted more than ownership projections. So my ownership model generally is around 0.8 R squared in unseen data, and we've shown it time and again this year when I post the ownership projections versus the actual, it's been over 0.8 other than this past weekend at Auto Club, where we had one of the most remarkable circumstances of with 13 drivers missing qualifying. Model didn't know how to handle that. It wasn't very good. So, it wasn't – not that it was bad. It was still – I think the R squared was around 0.68 or 0.7, but it was certainly on the low end there. But I think we could see something like that at Martinsville, where instead of 0.8, 0.85, 0.9, maybe we're around 0.65, 0.7 without the the practice data there. But I think it'll actually impact the race projections more. Instead of going from a point low 0.4s, you might go down into the 0.2s for race projections. So either way, whether it impacts the ownership projections more or the driver projections more, ownership projections will still be more confident than driver projections, guaranteed. And we should definitely exploit that this weekend. If we have this weather event where we get no practice data.
Okay, so we've talked about weather for basically the entire show. Let's talk about some of the drivers. Hendrick Motorsports, those guys have struggled so far. Auto Club was no exception. But Martinsville, unlike any of the other tracks we have seen so far, you talked earlier in the show about how track history is important. How are you evaluating the Hendrick Motorsports cars this weekend?
Yeah, this is a key question because they've been bad. I mean, we saw they were bad at Auto Club. They struggled just, to get drivers into the top 10. Chase Elliott had his worst race of the season. Even though he crashed out of other races, it was his worst race by average running position. Not very good. They've struggled. They've absolutely struggled. And it's interesting because Kyle Larson has performed very well this year. He's continued to perform very well. Jamie McMurray had a better car than all the Hendrick cars this past weekend. So, I think it's definitely something going on with Hendrick there where they haven't gotten accustomed to this new Camaro as well as the new NASCAR aero packages and rules, and they're struggling to get a grip on. The thing is, Martinsville is much less dependent on aero package. and much more in the driver's hands. Now, obviously, mechanical grip still matters at Martinsville, and getting your car to turn through the corners and all that is still very important, but the driver has a lot more influence, and that's why we see something like track history instead of type history or just overall, you know, recent race history come into play. And track type is actually slightly, like I said, more weighted than last eight overall race history. So this is where some of the drivers like Jimmy Johnson can overcome that. I think experience certainly helps, and that's also why we see, I think, short-term and long-term Martinsville form come into play here. I mean, Jimmy Johnson has the seventh best driver rating at Martinsville over the last eight Martinsville races. If you're, you know, thinking of him as a driver that is more like a low 8K or something like that range driver, you're going to be missing out on him. So, you know, definitely don't discount the guy who has, what is it, 11 grandfather clocks at Martinsville, something like that. We made the joke, what was it, the other weekend about daylight savings time and how Jimmy Johnson had to change all his clocks. But, yeah, he might add another clock to that collection this weekend. I certainly wouldn't be surprised. So focus much more on track history than what's going on with the Hendrick Motorsports cars this year in 2018. And I think you'll be okay. I mean, that's why we see drivers – I mean, obviously we're going to dive into drivers, but like that's why we see drivers like AJ Allmendinger or Danica Patrick even do well at Martinsville, because it's a rhythm track, and Danica Patrick was always able to get into a rhythm at Martinsville, and she produced multiple top 15 finishes, whereas she had very few top 15 finishes in her career. She had multiple top 15 finishes at Martinsville, so it's certainly a track that benefits drivers more than, you know, relying on team history.
Okay, looking at the key stats that you've identified for Martinsville, who are the top-tier drivers in the best position for success?
Yeah, I think number one overall, pretty much a slam dunk, is Kyle Busch. We've seen what he's done this year. He's dominated multiple races, or, you know, been a dominator in multiple races. He's been in the hunt for multiple wins. He also has a great Martinsville history. Last eight Martinsville races, 128.3 driver rating, which is, I think it's insane for a track that has you know, potential for so many DNFs. His average finish is 2.8 over the last eight Martinsville races. I mean, I think that's just bananas that that is, you know, his average finish is 2.8 over the last, I should say, that was over the last six. Over the last eight, it's 5.6 and then 117 driver rating. But still, that's bananas for Kyle Busch. But, he's definitely the go-to guy here. You look at short-term, long-term history. Kyle Busch is the one that has the best Martinsville track history. Another guy who's right up there is Brad Keselowski, second-best driver rating. And you know, he's led 12.9% of the laps over the last six Martinsville races. So, you know, I think Kyle Busch and Brad Keselowski, especially if Keselowski is maybe undervalued relative to Kyle Busch, Truex, Kevin Harvick, I think Keselowski is a very sneaky play this weekend, you know, because if you look at the top four, it's Kyle Busch, then Brad Keselowski, then Truex, then Kevin Harvick in terms of average finish at Martinsville. And all four of those guys show up in the top five in driver rating, along with Joey Logano as well, who could be kind of a sneaky play here. Then the next two names, Denny Hamlin and Jimmy Johnson in driver rating, are two names that are synonymous with Martinsville success. So those are really your top six, but I think of those top six, I like getting on Brad Keselowski. I like getting on Joey Logano because it's an equalizer here, and we know those guys have talent. So I think they could be, especially Logano, could be the lowest owned of those, you know, those big six names that I just mentioned, or big seven, I should say: Kyle Busch, Keselowski, Logano, Truex, Harvick, Hamlin, and Johnson. I think Logano might be the driver to exploit this weekend, especially if we don't get any practice.
Okay, any of the drivers in that middle tier or maybe kind of lower tier who stand out to you based on the key stats?
Yeah, well, we always have to mention AJ Allmendinger. He has an 80.8 driver rating at Martinsville over the last six races. He's had some ups and downs, some wrecks, but generally his average running position in the non-DNF races that he's had has been very good. So, you know, AJ Allmendinger is a driver, 10.5 average running position in his non-DNF races, would put him sixth best among all drivers. So a driver we should always mention at Martinsville. But I do think because he's always mentioned at Martinsville, his ownership percentage could be pretty high. I think another name in terms of the mid-tier that kind of stands out is Jamie McMurray. I mean, I mentioned the big seven there. And then after the big seven, it's kind of a jumble between a bunch of drivers, but a couple expensive drivers and then some cheaper drivers like Jamie McMurray, 83.1 driver rating at Martinsville. And I know he struggled a bit this year, although last week at Auto Club was a lot better for him. But I know he's had his struggles this year. But this is, again, a driver's track, and Jamie McMurray seems to do pretty well at here. Usually keeps his nose pretty clean. So I like Jamie McMurray in the mid-tier. You also have to like Ryan Newman in that mid-tier. Newman and McMurray, I think, oftentimes they show up at very similar tracks, tracks where experience comes into play, tracks where keeping your nose clean comes into play. Both of these guys tend to show up at your tracks like Phoenix and Martinsville, for example. So in the mid-tier, Jamie McMurray and Ryan Newman, I think, are great plays this weekend. And finally, in terms of a driver that might be like cheaper, just because he's on a less premium team, is Casey Kane. He's at Levine Family Racing, right? And he's dropped down to that team that Michael McDowell was on last year, no longer at Hendrick Motorsports. Well, if we're going to give him a huge discount just because he changed teams, I think that could be a mistake. He basically has the same driver rating as Ryan Newman, AJ Allmendinger, you know, Blaney and McMurray over the last six Martinsville races. And now we get a big discount on him because of him switching teams there. I think Casey Kane is a super interesting name this weekend for DraftKings purposes.
Okay, and any drivers we should be looking to avoid based on the key stats?
Well, if we're talking about drivers, you know, to look at avoiding, it like you said, it has to be relative to their price or to the key stats, and also relative to their price. And I think Kyle Larson is a driver that fits the bill, $9,700. He's not in the big seven there of the names that I mentioned. Sure, he's the next one, but he is priced at sixth best, and where he really should be priced maybe eighth or ninth best at Martinsville. I mean, I know you have to give some weight to this year history, so maybe he's fairly priced, but certainly this is not one of his best tracks. He's admitted that in the past, and I think Kyle Larson is a name that we can maybe avoid a little bit. Another name that I think is maybe a little bit – a couple names I think I should say that are a little bit bigger. These drivers in the 8K range, you know, you look at Kurt Busch, Clint Bowyer, Eric Jones, and Eric Almirola. Eric Almirola is 8,900, Kurt Busch 85, Clint Bowyer 83, and Eric Jones 81. They essentially make up the 8K tier other than Ryan Blaney at 8,700. Well, Blaney – has the highest driver rating of all these guys at 81.2. The next highest is Kurt Busch at 76.8 over the last eight Martinsville races. Then you have to go down to Clint Bowyer at 72.5, Eric Jones 71.9, and Eric Almirola, of course, on an inferior team at 66.3. So you probably give him a boost there, but it doesn't really push him above Kurt Busch or anything like that for me. So I think as well as the Stewart Haas cars have done this year, maybe there's a little bit of a disadvantage for them this weekend just because of their specific drivers. I mean, Almirola has never contended for a championship. Clint Bowyer's never really contended for a championship. He's won some races. Kurt Busch, been a champion in the past, won the Daytona 500 last year, but that's kind of an equalizer, but hasn't really been a contender for a championship in the past several years. So I think these Stewart Haas drivers could be a little overpriced and maybe drivers to avoid this weekend. I did talk about how Eric Almirola obviously was in lesser equipment. Clint Bowyer was in lesser equipment in the long form history. So he's one of those drivers, you know, if you look at short form Martinsville history versus long form Martinsville history, should get a boost just because of his short form Martinsville history being in Stewart Haas. But even then, Martinsville hasn't been a super crazy strong track for him this weekend. But I'd probably avoid somebody like Eric Almirola, who's priced at 8,900. I think I'm okay with Eric Jones, even though he's his driver rating, maybe if you were to adjust Almirola's for the team, Eric Jones' driver rating might be the lowest. He also has the best price point at 8,100. But yeah, I think this range is tough. Although that said, there's four very good cars here that are four very good drivers here that don't have super great Martinsville history. But if one of them ends up starting further back and there's a lot of variance, certainly one could squeeze into the top 10 in the winning lineup. I just wouldn't go necessarily crazy on any of these drivers unless we think their ownership percentage is going to be super low. Then that's going to be something to exploit in the positive direction, is to go overweight on one of these drivers because we're talking so negatively about them. But kind of a complicated situation. There's a lot of theory and dynamics to it, and we'll have to see how things play out on Saturday with practice and with the possibility of yes or no practice, yes or no qualifying. But at least as far as relative to salary and relative to the stats that we're looking at, these are four drivers I'd probably be avoiding.
Okay, Nick, what is the content schedule for this weekend?
So content schedule, tomorrow I'm essentially going to be working on NASCAR content all day. I'm going to get everything prepped for the possibility of qualifying or not, the possibility of practice or not, but I'll have all my data prepped and ready to go. And I'll be following the news just like everybody else will be with regards to practice and qualifying. But as soon as I know when the last on-track activity will be concluded, if we have any, I'll get to work, right to work on the articles and updating the apps. The splits app will be updated tomorrow morning, probably around noon Pacific time, I would think, because that's not dependent on any of the data this weekend. But practice data and qualifying data do go into the model. They do go in the model is projections go into the ownership project or the optimizer, I should say. And then practice and qualifying data go into the SimScores app. So those apps will be dependent on when we know when the final on-track activity will be. And then I'll try to update them as soon as possible after we know, after we are, have a confirmation of when the final on-track activity will be. So after the final on-track activity ends and we have confirmation of that, I will update the apps, get my article out, and then get the Action Network betting article out as well. So it's going to definitely be a busy tomorrow for me. So I'm taking tonight off to enjoy a glass of wine and maybe a Tecate.
Man, I can't even. Okay, so I thought of this question here. And sim scores. How do you do sim scores without practice times?
Yeah, I think I'm going to just add the weight of practice time to zero. So the sim scores are weighted usually based off the model weights. For like 90% of the sim scores are based off the model weights as well. But if there's no practice, then I have to just weight the practice factors to zero. And we'll have a lot of things like driver history and track history. And of course, we'll be pulling in track history a lot more than we'll be pulling in driver history. And it'll essentially be completely ignoring practice times. It'll still pull in qualifying because where drivers start, it doesn't go into the model, but at least it'll show you, it'll pull up drivers starting in similar positions that have similar histories at Martinsville or similar tracks, because that'll help you with DFS purposes, knowing how these drivers finished that started maybe 25th. You know, I think they're, even though starting position doesn't show up in the model, I do like that. That's where I say 90% of it goes into the sim scores. I do like to throw in starting position because then it gives you an idea of other drivers that started in a similar position. But I'm going to set the sim score weights for practice to zero if there's no practice because it doesn't make any sense to weight practice at all. So it'll be the same sim scores. I'll just have to weight practice to zero and we'll see what pops up.
All right. That's fascinating. One quick note, next week there will be no show because there is no race, and also Nick is having his surgery. So, Nick, good luck with that.
Yeah, thank you. I'm nothing major. I deviated my septum many, 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 many years ago, and then about 2009, it was 2009, I broke my nose playing basketball. I beat up a guy, but he got one kick on me there. No, I'm just kidding. I turned around and his chest happened to be right there. Total fluke thing. But, my ENT told me not to get it fixed until I was done playing sports and, been done playing sports for a couple of years. So finally decided to get that fixed on a NASCAR off weekend. One other thing, RotoViz Live this weekend will be 3 hours before lineups lock. So it'll be 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific. So I'm gonna have to wake up early on Sunday just to do RotoViz Live for you guys. But RotoViz Live will be 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 a.m. Pacific, RotoviZ.com. No, twitch.tv/Tecate.
Okay.
RotoViz.com/live.
Yep. Okay. That's going to do it for this NASCAR edition of On the Daily. For Nick Giffen on Twitter at RotoDoc, I'm Matt Friedman, Matt at the Oracle. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to On the Daily, the RotoViz Daily Fantasy Sports Podcast, powered by RotoViz Radio. And special thanks to Randy E. Aguabo for the introduction. Please review the podcast on iTunes under the established RotoViz Radio feed. Contact us via email onthedailydfs@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter @onthedailydfs.